Session number 28933, Cyril Pierce, part 5.
Cyril, you were describing the airfield in Cairo Air you were flying from. Was it just level dirt, or was there anything on it, like steel runway or anything?
No, PSP you're talking about, pierced steel plating, no. It was ordinary, level earth, earthy sand it was. It was fairly hard, unlike the earth in it made it more compact, so that if it had been pure sand, of course, it would have been rots all the way, but it wasn't. It was a kind of earthy sand. And as far as I can remember, I don't remember them doing any more to it while I was there. There was only one snag if it rained, and we only had one tropical storm while I was at Cairo Ann, and we were due for an operation that night, but it was impossible to fly because as soon as the wheels started to go around, as you started to taxi out, the earth simply clogged all the way around the wheels and made it impossible to taxi, let alone fly, so that operation was scrubbed. But that's the only occasion when I can remember. It's the only occasion when an operation was scrubbed, and I don't remember any other rain while I was there.
And what were the living conditions like?
Well, we were living in bell tents. There was 8 to a bell tent. This was air crew were kept separate, of course, from the other, from the ground staff, because we had to sleep in the daytime because of night operations. So there were 8 to a bell tent. You could roll the sides of the bell tent up, as you can see on one of those photographs, to let the air in. But it was, we were told that it was a good idea not to have the whole crew together in one tent. It is better if we split up into 2 and 3, because if we were together all the day, as well as when we were flying at night, the friction could arise, as you could argue, you know, with each other. So I was in one tent with Jack Morvell, my WOP, and Eric Scott, my bomb aimer, and Jack and Eric Taylor and Ted Peters were in another tent, so we got on quite well. Of course, this was in June, at the beginning of the summer. It was very, very hot. We had water bowsers where you could get your water bottles. We were issued with water bottles, and also the odd thing is, before we left England, we were all issued with a 38 revolver. Smith & Wesson, and 12 rounds of ammunition. What the hell were we going to do with those? I've no idea. But we were all issued with one. And of course, it was, and also a water bottle and a topi. None of us ever wore a topi. And in fact, they were all chucked away. We were able to get, although the town of Cairo Ann was out of bounds, the peddlers from the town used to come round and they sold us little pitchers, clay pitchers, where we could get the water from the water bowser and hang it up to let it help it to cool off. The water wasn't exactly rationed, but you weren't wasteful with it. And to start off with, of course, we had to wash ourselves down. We were all issued with a little canvas, a little stand with the canvas thing on, where you poured your water in and then washed yourself. You had to strip off, and of course, no women around, so you stripped off stark bollock naked and washed yourself down. But then we were surrounded, the airfields were surrounded by the fields of watermelons, and the farmer had a well of his own, and he had a camel which used to drop a big canvas bag down the well. A leather bag, and then the old camel would walk around, and the bag would come up, and it would then be tipped out down a kind of little slope which led to the irrigation system. So when we found this out, of course, every time he always did this later in the afternoon, and so we always to go there with our soap and towels, again all stark bollock, and then wash. Other things we had, the water from the bowser, of course, were used for cleaning tea. You had to make absolutely sure none of the water from this well went into your mouth, because it was full of germs. We had, the sergeant's mess, of course, had its own mess tent and its own, and in the evening that was turned into a bar. The other ground staff had their own mess tent, and the officers had theirs. The very worst part about this was the flies. There were swarms and swarms of flies. You couldn't get away from them. You go to the mess tent, and you took your mug for your tea to the mess tent. You always took, of course, your own knife, fork and spoon. Irons, we call them in the Air Force. You took your irons there, and then you would have your food. And it wasn't particularly good. There was a hell of a lot of bully beef, because, don't forget, we weren't a desert squadron. The desert squadron blokes had been there for donkey's years, and they knew all the ropes. The other desert squadrons used to call us the Limeys, because we were brand new in the desert. And you went to the mess tent, you would get your meal, and before you could say tuppence, it would be covered with flies. You had to wave it away. Then you had to go and get your tea, and when you got your tea in your mug, again, there'd be half a dozen dead flies drowning in it. It was the worst possible thing. You couldn't get away from flies. We were issued with mosquito nets, and we had to take anti-malarial tablets, but there were sand flies there as well, so there was sand fly fever, as well as malaria, if anybody wasn't taking their anti-malarial tablets. So in the end, what quite a lot of us did, we got our, we'd have a piece of paper, and we'd go and get our meal from the mess tent and cover it with paper, get back to our tent underneath the mosquito net and eat the meal under the mosquito net. And of course, when you open the mosquito net, half a dozen flies would get in anyway. And with drinking tea, of course, you had to keep fishing out these dead flies. Some years ago, Doreen suggested we go for a holiday in Tunisia, and I said, no bloody way, never will I go back to Tunisia. Jippy Tummy, and of course, it meant that you couldn't avoid Jippy Tummy, a form of dysentery, because of the fire. You couldn't get away from them. And that made it very difficult, because there was a latrine, which of course was a trench dug in the earth some way away from the camp, with just a trestle, a wooden plank, which you had to make sure you were sitting over properly, and then you did your business down into the trench. And of course the trench was full of poop, as you can see, and toilet paper was scarce, and it was very rough. The scorpions and spiders and other things that were actually in this trench were uncountable. There were so many of them. Eventually, they got L-SANs, you know what an L-SAN is, and they scattered them around the camp. And so if you wanted to do a crap, normally if you wanted to do a pee, you went about 30 yards away from your tent and did a pee in the sand. But to do a crap, of course, you had to go on the L-SAN, and there you'd be, nothing, no covering around it, just an L-SAN, lift the lid up and do your crap, hoping and taking something with you to swore to keep off the flies. The food did get better as the cooks got more experience, and of course the cooks were quite crafty, because we had Arab peddlers coming round selling things like the pitchers I've already explained, and they were selling eggs too, and the exchange rate, we were issued with the army scrip, which was of course in French francs, as it was still part, that was Tunisia was still French. They didn't want that, so we bartered with cigarettes, but then they we were given an issue of cigarettes every week, I forget how many, and they were practically always Camels, the American cigarette, and then they started issues V cigarettes, which we all reckoned were made out of camel dung, because they were terrible bloody things, and even the Arabs wouldn't take them when we were trying to barter with them, they wouldn't take them. But the cooks had a nice little game going. After, when they brewed up the tea, they used to dry out the tea leaves, spread it all out, dry it out, and flog this to the Arabs as tea. And it took some time before the Arabs realised that it had already been used, but they still used it and bought it. Those cooks must have made a lot of money in the desert. At the bar at night, to begin with, the only thing we had was Algerian wine, Marsala, which is a sweet Algerian wine. Now, I was a beer drinker, and so the first night we went into the bar, we had to take our own mugs, there were no glasses, and of course we kept drinking this Marsala as though it was beer. And of course we all got this as drunk as newts. As that was all there was, we did have an issue of beer, one man, one bottle, perhaps per week. It didn't always come. Once we had an issue of Guinness, but it had all gone sour. But anyway, we used to drink a lot. We got very drunk, because what I've since realised is, of course, this is why we were able to avoid this trauma, because we got so drunk that we didn't know about it when we were not flying. It was very hot, as you can imagine, in the desert. But after a while, you became acclimatised to it. Nobody wore a topi, and quite a lot of us went around even without shirts on. We got so used to the desert heat. The people I felt sorry for were the ground crew, who had to work on the aircraft, inside the aircraft, in the heat of the day, when the outside temperatures would have been about 120 in the shade. And in the aircraft, of course, which, don't forget, was painted the dark brown colour on the top and black underneath, it must have got stifling hot, and they had to work in under those conditions. When we did an air test, we again had to do it in daytime. After work had been done on the aircraft, you had to test it to see that it was going. And when you actually got into the aircraft, although you were just wearing shirts and shorts and shoes and a flying helmet, it was really like walking into a greenhouse. It was so damned hot. And the only time, one of the things was, you when you went on ops, you took your water bottle with you and left it in the aircraft, and by the time you were on your way back, it had cooled off lovely. So you had a nice cool drink of water coming back home. Briefings were held. All pilots had to attend the flight hut every morning to see whether you were on the battle order that night. But I, of course, had to do a trip as a second pilot, and so I need to look at my book. The flight out from Portreath to Fez in Morocco was through the Bay of Biscay, and there were a lot of Junkers 88s shooting down aircraft. That was counted as an operation. We had to fly a long way out into the Atlantic, and then eventually, when we thought it was right, turn towards the east and hit the French, the African coast. So that was operation number one for me, the flight from Portreath to Ras El Mar. My first trip, I got to the squadron on the 1st of June, 43, and my first trip was with a sergeant Wallace on an operation to Messina, but one of the engines started to play up on the way out, and he just turned round, dropped his bombs on the village, and that did count as a second operation, although it wasn't any good to me because I'd not seen any defences. So I then had to do another second dicky trip with an Aussie pilot called Flying Officer Radford to the airfield on Sicily, Castel Vetrano, which of course was very heavily defended. It was all German aircraft there and German anti-aircraft guns, and they were very good. And there was quite heavy flak there, but he dropped his stick right across the runway, and it was that therefore counted as my first second dicky trip. My first solo operation was on Messina, which is on the Straits of Messina, between Sicily and Italy. And although I attacked at 8,500 feet, we got a stick of bombs right across the ferry. My next trip, as you know, the Germans were expecting us to invade either Sicily or Sardinia. And you might have read the book or seen the film about the bloke they planted, the dead man they planted in the sea with all the documents on saying we were going to invade Sardinia. So to try and put them off a bit, my next trip was on the port of Olbia in Sardinia. I was coned by two searchlights and finally got away. I hit the docks, I had the aerial on top of the plane had come adrift in my evasive action, and it took us a while to get for Jack to get in touch with base to get the right heading to get home.
But Cyril, how did you evade the searchlights? Did you?
Well, the point was, I'll tell you later on about an actual thing where I was caught, really caught by searchlights. But the point was that if the master searchlight was always a blue one, and if that got you, you had to get out of that very, very quickly, because if it held on to you, then all the other searchlights around would cone you, and once they got you in a cone, then you were finished, because all the flak could see you, and they would just shoot you down. So you had to make sure you weren't caught. So with that, I couldn't really have been coned by two. I must have had two came on me, because I don't really remember.
Cyril, go through a sort of a normal operational day when you found out that you were on an operation.
Right, you would unless you had been on a night flight. Pilots had to attend the flight tent to see the battle order. Every day, the squadron leader in charge of the flight and his assistant would make out, they would be given the bomb load, the petrol load, but nothing else, and then they would make out a battle order. That is, the people who they wanted to fly on which aircraft to on the actual raid. So you would go down to the flight hut, the flight tent, and you always, whenever you went into the flight hut, or the flight tent as we had, you always saluted as a remembrance of the big people who had been there before you and had never come back. Always saluted when you went into the flight tent or hut. And that happened everywhere on every squadron in the RAF. If you're on the battle order, then you'd be told to go to the briefing with your navigator. With your navigator, you would go there, you would be told the target. The navigator would be given the maps and the target, and then he would have to then work out his own course and the time of the attack. He would give the time of takeoff and the time of the attack. He would have to do that, work out all his course there. Then you would have to attain the main briefing, where all the crews would attend. Now, at Clairawan, you just had to stand up. There was no place big enough for all the crews to sit down. So you stood up, and the station commander or the wing commander would give a full briefing, where it was, what time it was, the bomb load, and give you takeoff times and the time to start bombing. They never bothered in the desert to tell you what height or in which direction you were to bomb. That was left entirely up to you. And of course, at this time, the Pathfinder Force was operating in England, where they had masses of aircraft, and of course they had all those had to be given a height to go out at, and the course to go out at, and a bombing time, simply because there were so many aircraft there, and the same coming back with Bomber Command from England. Because in order to try and avoid mid-air collisions, there were so many aircraft. Now, with six squadrons in the desert, a maximum effort, that was every aircraft which was fit to fly, with six squadrons, it would be 20 from each squadron, that's 10 from each flight, as there are two flights in the squadron. So the most we could muster was 120. And so it was left entirely up to you which height you would bomb from, and from which direction. Because don't forget, when you're going to a target, 360 degrees, you can attack it from any way you want. And so that was entirely up to us. We were given the time when we would be picked up by the lorries, the three tonners, to be taken out to the aircraft. And they would take us out, because don't forget, they're all dispersed all across around the airfield, some of the aircraft were a good mile away from the airfield, and you'd go out there, and then of course you knew what time you would load up, navigator would take all his stuff on, you would be wearing, of course, your Maywests and parachutes. The wireless operator would have his special box of codings he would take on, and all the pilot took on was himself, and the same with the bomber and the rear gunner. And you would start the engines, test them, and then give the okay to the ground crew that was okay, sign a Form 700. This had to be signed to say that you had accepted the aircraft as being fit to fly. Sign that. The ladder would be pulled up from the ground, the doors closed, chocks moved, and you would taxi off to the end of the runway, and then when you got the green light, you would take off. Now, what's the first thing you do, you think, when you take off from a runway in an aircraft? What's the very first, what can you think of the very first thing you do? But don't forget that when the aircraft took off, and a Wimpy would become airborne at about 90 miles an hour, your undercarriage wheels would be spinning round at a tremendous rate. So you put the brakes on to stop the wheels. If you didn't, you lifted the wheels into the undercarriage, spinning, you would get a hell of a stink of burning as they were rubbing, touching things, and they wouldn't do the wheels or the undercarriage any good. Then you say you became airborne. After putting the brakes on, you pulled your wheels up straight away, and then you gradually climbed height. Now the Wimpy, with a full petrol load and a full bomb load, climbed at 400 feet a minute. And when you see these modern aircraft, which can get up to about 5 miles in about 40 seconds, it's a bit different. And as, of course, you were climbing, you turned onto the course which your navigator had given to you, and you headed towards your target. I did explain earlier on about navigation, didn't I? So I won't go through that again. But as we were, of course, all our operations from Tunisia were over the sea, we had flame floats. And the rear gunner, the navigator would say to the rear gunner, Ted, drop a flame float. And when it hit the sea, the rear gunner would turn his turret so that his guns pointed towards the flame float and would read off on a little scale, would give that to the navigator, who would then calculate what the wind speed was. Because don't forget, wind speed is most important. It takes the aircraft with it. And he would do that two or three times, so that by the time you got to the coast of Italy, he should have a pretty accurate wind speed.